Today we continue, oh, I guess it's a little bit of a tradition anyways. I jokingly call it Town Hall Ohio's Greatest Hits. As we close out the year for 2018, we're going to go back and revisit some of the highlights of this year's broadcasts. The election, farm and food issues, short and long-term economic concerns and opportunities, especially in rural areas. You're going to hear some pretty smart and interesting people who've graced our studio over the past year. It is 2018 in review on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
We are nearly 2 months past the election, and I still cringe at that onslaught of TV ads, robocalls, and candidate flyers. We opened 2018 with a roundtable of State House reporters who joined us to look ahead to the election. Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio, and Jackie Borchert of Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer were in with us to talk about the upcoming primaries and just how big of a mess things were in January.
There are 9 declared candidates today. Rich Cordray this morning, actually the number of declared candidates went down because he got one to be his running mate, former Congresswoman Betty Sutton. The one that's up in the air, of course, is former Cleveland mayor and congressman and former state senator Dennis Kucinich, who sent a letter to Fox News saying, you know, I'm going to run for governor. Since then, his spokesperson says, well, he's actually just thinking about it.
So Richard Cordray, Connie Pillich, Joe Schiavone, let me scratch Betty Sutton as we speak
right
here, Nan Whaley, Supreme Court member Bill O'Neill, and potentially Dennis Kucinich.
That's for the Dems.
For the Dems. And Andy, on the R side, it trimmed from original 4 down to 3.
Down to 3. So, yeah, you have Mike DeWine, who chose John Husted as his running mate. So you have those two running on the same ticket. And then you have Jim Renacci, current congressman, and Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor. And you know, if we really want to go down this rabbit hole, there is some conversation about Jim Renacci possibly switching over to a different race, because Josh Mandel, the Republican running for U.S. Senate, who would then run against Sherrod Brown, Mandel has dropped out of that U.S. Senate race, and there's talk that maybe Renacci would be interested in jumping into that race instead.
I'm no political advisor, Jackie, but I know the parties in many cases would prefer to have one person. They don't have to spend any money on primaries. They can start gearing up for the general. So as you hear from leadership within both the Republican and Democratic parties, what are they saying out loud, and what do you think they're thinking about having this mess of candidates on both sides?
You hit the nail on the head. They would prefer that this would not be a bloodbath of any sort going in, you know, a primary. If you have a primary that depletes a lot of your resources, then you're in an unfortunate position going into the general. So actually the party leaders on the Republicans and the Democrats have tried to maintain, you know, this public position of neutrality. I'm sure there's probably some maneuvering, behind the scenes. But, you know, no one wants to be seen in the public as from a chairman or chairwoman's point of view anyway, be seen as kind of, you know, doing that maneuvering and being a puppet master, if you will.
Of course, in May, the list of governor wannabes was trimmed down to 2. And both spent an hour in the Town Hall Ohio studio.
I'm Rich Cordray, and I'm running for governor because I believe in public service in the state. I believe about what it does to raise the quality of life in our communities all over the state. I believe that leadership matters, and how we solve problems by bringing people together matters. We see too much divisiveness and pitting people against one another and scapegoating and blaming coming from Washington. We don't need that in Ohio. That is not the Ohio way. The other thing I would say is I've shown throughout my time in public service that I'm willing to stand up to some of the most powerful special interests in our society on behalf of Ohioans. When I protected our pension systems against Wall Street and got back more than $2 billion from them, as the consumer chief in Washington, putting money back in the pockets of Americans and many Ohioans. And my opponent has shown that he is not willing to do that. 42 years of politics for Mike DeWine, and he has stood with the special interests every step of the way. And I think that's a fundamental difference between us. Who do you stand up for and who do you stand up to? And Rich Cordray will always stand up for Ohioans and make sure that our interests are advanced and that people can have an ear and have a voice, and so that we can work together to solve our problems and bring everyone to the table and leave no one out, and most of all our agricultural community, which is so important to our lifestyle here in Ohio and our way of life.
Cordray's Republican challenger and the eventual winner, Mike DeWine, also gave us his stump speech.
I have a real vision for where I want to take this state. My experience has been that when you go into office, you better know where you want to go. We want to focus on jobs. We want to make Ohio the number one state in the Midwest for a place to raise your family, number one place to grow a business, number one place if you're contemplating moving to a state and creating a business. We want Ohio to be that place. We do it by keeping taxes down. We do it by focusing on keeping the regulations rational and reasonable. We need to have a business-friendly environment. We need to also, frankly, fully understand that our agriculture community remains the number one industry in the state of Ohio. I'm someone who not only has farmland and lives on a farm, but someone who is in the seed business, and my parents were, my grandparents, so we really, I think, have a pretty good appreciation for the challenges that agriculture farmers have out there. And I want to be their partner and the partner for everyone in the state.
I will mention with some pride that ahead of the 2018 election, all of the major party candidates made the time to visit with Ohio Farm Bureau and with you on this radio show. Both DeWine and Cordray, throughout their campaigns, talked a lot about the Ohio economy, and it is a good thing they did. This past summer, we aired two shows that talked about Ohio's long-term, serious economic structural challenges. It was focused on a report entitled Toward a New Ohio, authored by Bill Scuhardy and Dr. Fran Stewart. Bill is a distinguished adjunct professor at the John Glenn College of Public Affairs at Ohio State. Fran is a senior research fellow at OSU's Ohio Manufacturing Institute. They describe the report Toward a New Ohio as the intersection of politics and economic reality. So why did they write it?
Well, the purpose is you've got, for the first time in a number of years, non-incumbents running for governor. So you're going to have a new governor. We thought this would be a good time to attempt to raise the level of the public debate over what that governor is going to do in terms of improving Ohio's economy. So it's more in terms of posing questions to the governor for what his answers are going to be, as opposed to saying you should do this or you should do that.
So, Fran, here's the easy job for you. Give us a recap of what we covered last week, and that basically was what happened to the Ohio economy from the late 60s through today. Kind of just give us the overview of what that megatrend looked like.
Well, Ohio has witnessed a steady decline in its economic well-being compared to the nation as a whole over the past 60 years. In 1953, Ohio's per capita personal income was 9% above the national average, and it's now more than 9% below. And much of this decline can be directly traced to the loss of 700,000 high-paying manufacturing jobs since manufacturing's employment peak in 1969. And many factors have contributed to that. What often gets focused on is foreign competition. But domestic competition, meaning companies that relocated to other states, that's been important. But the biggest contributor by far to the loss of manufacturing jobs has been automation. And so the automation has been has cut the number of Ohio workers, but it's also allowed Ohio manufacturers to be competitive and to produce twice what they did 50 years ago with half as many workers. So that's kind of in a nutshell where we stand today.
And one other point, the pain that has been felt in Ohio, not felt equally in all areas, correct?
That's true. It's tended to be that the large cities have, even those like Cleveland and Cuyahoga County that have suffered large losses of manufacturing jobs, they have a more diversified economy, and so they've been able to offset many of those losses in other industries like insurance and health care. But the smaller cities and the rural counties around the state have struggled to figure out what their new economy looks like and where the jobs of the future for them are going to be.
Our 2 hours with Schoharty and Stewart were enlightening, and while the election is behind us, I encourage you to go online and search Toward a New Ohio, learn the history of a sagging Ohio economy, and some thoughts on how state government should tackle the challenges. For the farm economy, 2018 began with worries that President Trump was going to back away from the North American Free Trade Agreement. Tad Nicholson of the Ohio Corn and Wheat Growers and OSU ag economist Ian Sheldon joined us to talk about not only the importance of NAFTA, but the overall importance of trade.
Joe, I'm just going to tell you flat out that exports is the most important market for a grain farmer today in Ohio. And that's difficult for a lot of people to understand that even a lot of farmers don't really fully realize it, because once the grain leaves our farm, you know, we don't get to follow it all the way to Japan or all the way to Mexico. And so the understanding that this is the biggest driver right now of profitability for a farmer right here in rural Ohio is tough to understand. But get this, though. I mean, half of our wheat leaves the country. Half of our soybeans, over half of our soybeans now, leaves our country. Over 25% of our corn. So if you're looking at, you know, this corn out here, understand that, you know, every fourth row is going to go somewhere outside the United States. And that should speak to the importance of this. And that's different from the past 10 years, let's say. You know, it was all about domestic, production, especially in the corn area. It was all about ethanol and this new market that was being developed, and the drivers were all domestic. Now, that's flattened off, and all the biggest drivers that are going to increase demand are outside the United States.
Ian, one of the challenges that we're talking about in dealing with trading with virtually any nation, I don't know if it'd be easier or better, but it seems like it. If Company A reached across the border and did business with Company B, if they were both satisfied, the deal would be done and the trade would take place. But government seems to have its fingers at every level of international business.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, if you were to open an undergraduate textbook on international trade, the argument would be unambiguously free trade is a good thing. And if politicians followed the advice of economists, we wouldn't be sitting here in the studio. That's absolutely correct. But, the political economy of trade is that governments both here in the U.S. and elsewhere in North America, but also, you know, in Europe and in developing countries, they're seeking re-election, and often they may choose to stand on a platform that either leads to not reducing tariffs or to protecting domestic markets. So yes, trade is highly politicized, because there are not only winners from trade, from firms in the export markets, and unambiguously consumers tend to benefit from trade, but obviously industries that are in import competing sectors obviously have an interest in trying to maintain market share, and will lobby their local, state, and national representatives about trade. So yeah, it's highly politicized.
We'll have more of 2018's Town Hall Ohio highlights after this. We are back reviewing a few of the shows from this past year that reflect what we'd like to do each week with Town Hall Ohio. Being a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau, of course, we spend time talking with folks in the farm and food sector. One show we did featured Gigi Neal and Tony Nye, both with the New and Small Farmer program that's run by Ohio State University Extension. I asked them about who their clientele is and why these folks want to get into farming.
They've gotten a few acres and they want to know what they can do with their property. And then they call me and they say, I have no idea. I've got 5 acres. I want to make a go at something. We have every age range you can think of, everywhere from a young individuals that are in their 20s and 30s to older individuals, even in their mid-40s, 50s, 60s. Some of them have been involved in agriculture and they're coming back to it. When they were a young age, a young teenager themselves, now they're coming back to it. So our average age is around 44 and a half years old.
What seems to be the motivating factors to jump into what could be a difficult undertaking?
The first thing that, you know, maybe someone that's not as involved in agriculture would come to think, why would someone want to get involved? Money might be the first thing. So do I want to develop a profit center? And actually, that's in the middle of the scope of things. Basically, a lifestyle is the number one choice of being involved in a small-scale agricultural enterprise or enterprises. Retirement becomes the second most important element when we've surveyed our clientele. And they look at this as an opportunity to get to know a little bit more about the blood, sweat, and tears that goes along with agriculture. And some of my best successes over the years of being involved has actually been talking people out of buying property because they didn't realize after reading all the fancy stories on the internet and some of the magazines that are out there looking at small farm production or hobby farm production, they didn't realize there was that much involved until, you know, we pretty much point blank tell them what it's like and give them a lot of fuel to think about.
If you happen to have one of those romanticized pictures of what it means to farm, you may have gotten it from your exposure to one part of Ohio agriculture, the state's large Amish community. On one show, we talked with Amish expert and author Susan Trollinger and with Kayla Jones, an Ohio Farm Bureau staff member who works in Amish country. And I asked how it came to be that Ohio has such a big Amish community and then what it's like to actually work alongside them.
Looking for a good farmland, and it turns out that Holmes County, Ohio, has some of the best farmland in the country. And the hills of Holmes and Wayne County also resemble the areas that they came from in Germany and Switzerland. And so they came here to farm.
If you're talking to somebody who's never been up into the Holmes County area, how do you describe what that community looks like and how it integrates with the English?
This is actually a conversation that I've had with one of my board members in Holmes County. We do have an Amish member that serves on the county board, and he's very willing to talk about the beliefs and their lifestyle and all those things. And when I asked him, what would you share that you want the English community to know about you? He really had some of the myths of Amish that he really wanted the world to know are not true. So he was a little bit fired up about Amish don't pay taxes. I wanted to make sure that they really do pay taxes. They do have social security numbers and file taxes and everything just like every other person. We've talked a lot about religion and things, and just their beliefs are very similar to an average Christian believer, and they just have different ways of going about it. But in general, they're very similar people. They're great people to talk to. They're very personable, very nice, very respectful, and just generally good people who are doing what they love to do.
The Amish may be representative of the bucolic nature of rural Ohio. Unfortunately, there is a flip side. Opioid abuse in rural areas is rampant. I talked with USDA Assistant Secretary Ann Haslett and Ohio Farm Bureau's Yvonne Lasisco about the challenges.
This is a high priority for the Trump administration. It's really an all-hands-on-deck effort. And so our contribution is really to be a partner to local leaders as they build grassroots solutions to this issue that will work in their community. And we're doing that really through a number of resources that we have, through building partnerships, and then driving innovation through the adoption of model practices. And so opportunities like I have today to learn from the things that have begun on the ground and are working in Ohio is why I'm here.
Farmers are owning this this issue here in Ohio.
They absolutely are, because it's been devastating to our rural communities. And so farming is about agricultural production, and Farm Bureau is about agricultural production, but it's about that larger wanting the good quality of life, wanting communities that we can be proud of and where our kids want to stay around. And so we really look towards what can we do as Farm Bureau? Where is our strong point? What's our assets? And so that has always been networking, bringing people together, recognizing that we can be a leader who can kind of change the thought in a community. So you've got things like judicial systems and treatment centers, and there's all those aspects, but where we really wanted to focus our energy is on prevention to begin with. And so Hope for Ohio was a program that we put together. It's been a very, very collaborative effort. We had a statewide bringing together of folks last year to sit down and say, okay, a lot of students, it's been very student-based, 4-H, FFA, we've been working with Extension and Prevention Action Alliance. What can you do to be trained to talk to your peers, to say this isn't the right path, to know yourself, some of those warning signs for your fellow peers, for your fellow students, and be like, wow, I think we've got a problem here. So it's students teaching themselves, teaching others, kind of that peer-to-peer outreach. Parents recognizing you think you have a really stable home and you think, oh, well, my child's untouchable. They're not. Teaching parents to learn about some of those signals and some of those signs that are right there in view about the fact that they may have a problem in their own home. So a lot of discussion of prevention.
We will return right after this. Our recap of Town Hall Ohio from 2018 continues. Last March, for the 72nd year in a row, Ohio Farm Bureau County presidents traveled to Washington, D.C. for their annual educational and lobbying trip. As he always does, Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio met with the farmers and afterward talked with the media. At that time, Congress was still working to write the 2018 Farm Bill.
We've got a really good coalition because of the nutrition title and the farm programs title, whether it's conservation, whether it's rural development, whether it's safety net issues. And that we need to keep that coalition together. And I think that's worked for agriculture. It's worked for hungry kids in Appalachia and in the cities.
Senator Brown was asked about the political climate in Washington and whether that would affect their ability to get a farm bill written.
We don't let that tone creep into the Agriculture Committee. I mean, fundamentally, we have seen this committee continue to work the way that it should. So I think that will continue. And I think all of us, and I can't speak for my Democratic colleagues, but I think they all follow this mostly the same template of reaching out on that committee.
It took until just 2 weeks ago, but the Farm Bill was finally passed and sent to the president. That trip by Ohio Farm Bureau local leaders is one example of how the group flexes its political strength. I talked about that with American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall, who also took time to visit with the Ohio group.
You know, it's important for our farmers to come to town to, they say the same thing about the policy that we're pumping every day with our staff up on the hill. And when they come to town and they're the constituents of these congressmen and senators, they come to town and they just basically pave the road for us in our policy movement. And it makes us fulfill our mission of pushing our policy. You know, our policy comes from our farmers, and when they come to town, They actually get the actual work done when they come to town. So it's real important. Without their visits, we would never be able to accomplish all that we accomplish.
Back in Ohio, the single biggest policy issue for farmers in 2018 was the debate over how to address agriculture's role in improving water quality. We were pleased to get some thoughts on that from Jessica D'Ambrosio of the Nature Conservancy and Chris Winslow of Ohio State University's Sea Grant program. If they had to advise government leaders, what kinds of policy approaches would they recommend?
Well, I think it's important first to understand that the voluntary programs that we have in place have done a very good job, if I can use this analogy, of stabilizing our patient. Our patient is Lake Erie. So we've done a very good job of making the lake stable based on what we're putting into it currently. And I think what we can do is I would advise our policymakers to come up with some constructive policies and align that with funding that help us treat the root causes of the chronic illness. So we've stabilized the patient. How can we then now take the next step, treat the root causes of the illness and cure the disease?
Chris, your thoughts on if you were king for a day and got to make all our state's policy on water quality, what would be some things that you would feel are important to think about?
Yeah, so I mean, definitely a policy is a tool in the toolbox, but when you use that tool, you got to make sure that the farmer can afford to do it monetarily, but also temporally. There are some things that we're asking farmers perhaps to do that it's just not feasible within the planting season or the growing season. And so we need to do, if a policy is put in place, it needs to have support for that farmer, both monetarily and make sure they have enough time to implement those.
Right, and that support comes from being constructive, enabling farmers to be able to make decisions, and being flexible enough to say, okay, well, I know there's a range of options available to me. How can I choose from this range of options that best fits my system?
One of my favorite shows every year is bringing in the finalists for the Young Ag Professionals Discussion Meet competition. The YAP program is a leadership development activity sponsored by Ohio Farm Bureau. I talked with this year's finalists about why Young Ag Professionals is valuable. Here are Annie Speck, Jacob Holscher, Casey Ellington, and Seth Middleton.
Really the opportunity to develop people skills. You know, a lot of folks in agriculture, we've got specific training in whatever commodity that we work in. We might have, you know, vocational training, college educations in those fields, but we don't always focus so much on the people side of things. And being a communication instructor, you know, communication and people are my thing. And so I really like to talk about the Young Ag Professionals program as an opportunity for young people to learn to have candid and polite discussions about really controversial issues, to talk to news media, to talk to policymakers, and how to make those interactions positive whenever possible.
I mean, growing up on a farm, you're used to your parents or grandparents' way of doing things, or maybe your friends or just your small geographical region. And even in Ohio, as small a state as it is, there's hundreds of different ways to run a farm. And to go to these Young Ag conferences, you get to see every different way.
There's a lot of networking opportunities. That's the one thing I've been having a lot of discussions with some young and upcoming leaders in my neck of the woods, young girls getting ready to graduate and things like that, and trying to find those jobs in agriculture. And I say, well, you need to come and experience this conference.
As I came on as a Farm Bureau member, began to learn a lot about the policy and the responsibilities that we have as a group.
Some bright young folks there. I'm sure you'll hear their names again, probably as leaders in Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. And we'll have the next round of Discussion Meet leaders on the show here coming up in just a couple of months. We're spending today looking back at 2018, some of the highlights of Town Hall Ohio over the past year. We'll be back to continue that in just a few moments. One of my personal favorites from 2018 Town Hall Ohio broadcasts was when we recorded in front of several hundred Farm Bureau members in Columbus for an Ag Day event. And our guest was Liliana Esposito. She is the chief spokesperson for Wendy's. Liliana had lots of good information for the consumers who buy Wendy's food and for the farmers who supply it. I asked her if Wendy's has a role in connecting producers and consumers.
Without question. And really, Wendy's was founded not as a restaurant, but as a food company. We take very seriously the role that we play in feeding families, and I know that you all do as well. And the difference between Wendy's and many of you in this room is that we get to talk to those consumers every single day. And so they tell us what they think about the food that you produce. They tell us what they would like to see in that food, and they tell us what they would like to see changed. And so I think the role that we can play is as a communicator to the consumer about the value that you bring, but also a communicator back to the production community about what the consumer is asking us for.
The Wendy's brand, mm-hmm. It's important that you take the steps that protect it. Do you think that applies to agriculture as well? Do we need to make sure that the general public has this overall brand image of food producers in Ohio that's favorable?
I do. I think it's critical. And we've seen a lot of research, and maybe you've seen it here as well. The image of the farmer, and particularly the American farmer, is very, very positive. And the image of, for instance, veterinarians that may care for your animals if you're a livestock producer, very, very positive. The challenge comes in that because so few consumers are connected to the farm anymore. I mean, there's the, you know, single digit percentages of the American public that has any connection to agriculture. They don't necessarily know that what you do is farming. and it may not match their perception of what they think farming is, which typically is a much smaller scale, kind of old-fashioned idea of how they think it should be. And so you have to play a role in educating them about why you do the things that you do, how you do it to improve safety, to improve quality, why in some cases a more modern approach is better, and why in other cases it might not be. And so that really is a critical role, that, and you are the only ones that can do it. You're the only ones that can bring your story to the public. And it's hard because you're busy. You are up at the crack of dawn. You are working your farms every single day, and you're taking care of your families and you're taking care of your communities. And so to add extra time to educate a consumer that you don't necessarily see every day is hard, but really I think it's the only way that you can increase awareness and understanding of what you do for a living.
We also visited the topic of consumer food expectations in a conversation with John Barker, president of the Ohio Restaurant Association, and Farm Bureau Executive Vice President Adam Sharp.
I think when you look at things like the actual food, that hasn't really changed in terms of what people desire. They desire as high quality of food, and therefore the ingredients that go into them, as they can possibly get. I think it changes a little bit depending on the economic kind of strata that a person comes from. We do notice that people who are at the lower end of the economic strata are using food more often as fuel, just to sort of kind of get through the day. And interestingly, a few years ago, when the move to put calories on menu boards was sort of the rage, and the regulators were doing it because they thought it'd get people to eat fewer calories. As we did the analysis, what we found is many people will go in and pick the lowest price and the highest calories because they were actually trying to build the calories for the day. On the other hand, as people, you know, move up a little bit further in their economic kind of situation in life, and particularly as they get a little bit older, people are very focused then on taste and enjoying the food and having great service and hospitality and relaxing, and sometimes being able to pair foods with the right sorts of drinks and things like that. I mean, they
it's
really
an experience as much as a meal.
Exactly. And it's a way to just kind of get away from whatever you were doing the rest of the day.
If you go back 20, 30 years, it was hard to kind of start a conversation around food production. Was a difficult conversation to start. Still can be. But it's interesting, those expectations of what's out there now versus, you know, the kind of the reality and the interest that's there and the science that's there. And, we hear a lot about issues like genetically modified organisms or GMOs. We hear a lot of things about pesticides or hormones and you know, what's in the food and how's the food produced. Farmers are always talking to us as their organization about talking to the consumer about food literacy. You know, how does their food get produced? Where does it come from? What's the real science behind that? What's the technology that's used to produce it? It's kind of a grand discussion because farmers at the same time, many of them adapting and learning and changing the way they're producing food to meet these demands of consumers. And at the same time, the volume of food in the marketplaces that are there, of using the available technologies, the safe technologies, proven technologies to also produce the volume of demand that's there. It's sometimes an interesting conversation to have with consumers.
We'll be back after the break. Rural America faces challenges, something we addressed on a Town Hall Ohio earlier this year in a visit with Mike Jacoby, who works in economic development.
You know, I used to live in Columbus, and I go to Columbus frequently, and Columbus is just doing phenomenally well. The fastest growing major metro in the Midwest. And the Urban Land Institute recently said that Columbus is supposed to gain 600,000 people by 2050. If you look at projections for Ohio's growth, it's only going to be 110,000 people in that same time period. So, and the birth rate is really not consequential. So really that means they're predicting about 500,000 Ohioans will leave other parts of Ohio and head to central Ohio. And so this is one of the challenges that makes our work really important, is because I came from a small town. My parents are still in a small town. I live in a small town. I'd like to see our quality of life, our way of living, our communities remain vibrant and sustainable. And if my kids want to, you know, stay in a small town, I'd like them to have that opportunity.
Farm Bureau's 2018 annual meeting kicked off our organization's centennial celebration. History book author Craig Lovelace looks back at our beginnings.
My points of research started even before the Civil War and right after the Civil War, because all the problems that farmers faced, whether it be manipulation of the markets, railroad fees, what some called usury fees of banks, all that started right after the Civil War as America was industrializing. And each time that the farmer tried to stand up to himself, he or she got smacked down. So when the Farm Bureaus started, and they were the result of all these various pieces of legislation that gave them the ability to gather together to buy and sell cooperatively and hopefully raise their standard of living. 1919 was like the culmination. The war had just ended. Farmers played a heck of a role in feeding the Allied troops, but they still felt that they needed a buying mechanism to help the body agriculture. And so they informally got together in early 1919 and said, let's do it.
In his annual meeting speech, Executive Vice President Adam Sharp highlighted 100 years of accomplishments.
In 1926, the Farm Bureau Mutual Automobile Insurance Company was founded. And of course, in 1955, that became nationwide. In 1931, the Farm Bureau Agricultural Credit Corporation was formed to help farmers with financing. The Farm Bureau in 1935 created the Rural Electrification Cooperative, which was absolutely instrumental in getting electricity to rural Ohio. In 1947, WRFD Radio was founded, and of course, its purpose was to spread news and our farm messages. In 1967, the personal property tax for farmers was repealed. And in 1973, of course, we passed the constitutional amendment creating the CAUV tax system. In 81, we formed our Agricultural for Good Government Political Action Committee, which is absolutely critical to supporting our elected friends. In 2001, we launched the Our Ohio magazine that's become very popular across the state. In 2008, we built the nationwide and Farm Bureau 4-H Center at The Ohio State University. And in 2009, we created the Livestock Care Standards Board. And in 2013, we eliminated the Ohio estate tax. 2017 saw the reform of the CAUV system that has allowed 30% savings for our farmers. And in 2018, we defeated an ill-conceived plan to have state government dictate farming practices. All of these things, and literally thousands more of these types of accomplishments, both large and small, have gotten done. And they've gotten done by men and women, just like you, sitting in farm shops and in meeting rooms all across the state of Ohio, identifying problems and coming up with the solutions.
And Sharp looked to the future.
100 years from now, what will our grandkids and our great-grandkids say about the Farm Bureau on our 200th anniversary? I know what they'll say. They'll say we honored our traditions. They will say that we prepared for the future. And they will say our organization adapted to the world around us. And they will also say we never abandoned our principles. We are the lucky few who have the privilege to be here at our 100th annual meeting, where we are celebrating the past and setting a course for the future.
Thanks for joining us for a look back at some highlights of 2018 on Town Hall Ohio.
Town Hall Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall Ohio.